Lawyers ready? Okay. I'll ask the clerk to call the second case then.
The court will now call the City of Arlington, Texas versus Texas Oil and Gas Association and Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association. May it please the court, Mr. Joseph W. Spence will argue for the appellant. Mr. David F. Johnson will argue for the appellant.
Okay, Mr. Spence, ready to go forward?
May it please the court, Joe Spence for the City of Arlington. I believe the question before the court today involves prong three of the associational standing test. I know the court is probably fairly familiar with that in light of an opinion that came out on August the 15th. I believe Justice Walker, you authored, and Justice Gardner was on the panel, the Big Rock Investor case. I think the issue in this case is under prong three, do the trade association plaintiffs in this case, in order to prove one or more of the causes of action alleged, have to do so by involving individual participation of the members of the trade associations? And we believe that the answer to that question is yes, unequivocally yes. And so we would request that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court and enter judgment that the trade associations lack standing. Excuse me. Associational standing, as the court knows, and especially under prong three, requires the court to look at the nature of the claim and the relief sought. Clearly, it seems that the cases say that if the relief sought is actual damages, then trade associations have no associational standing. But that's not really the issue, I think, before this case, or before this court in this case, because it's unquestioned that the trade association plaintiffs here only sought declaratory relief. And the general rule seems to be that when an associational plaintiff seeks some sort of declaratory injunctive or prospective equitable relief, that there's sort of this idea that maybe they do have associational standing, but it's not automatic. We pointed that out in our brief, and I believe that was pointed out in the Big Rock Investors case. It's not automatic, and the reason it's not automatic is because the court is required to look to the nature of the claim, and that seems to involve two components under the law. One, does the nature of the claim and the association's proof requirement require proof of the member's circumstances? And then there seems to be a corollary to that that says, or does it require a fact-intensive individual inquiry of the members? And so here, our motion for summary judgment, which was not a plea to the jurisdiction, but the cases seem to suggest procedurally either one is proper. Our motion basically said, when you look at the nature of these claims, and there's basically four causes of action that were asserted, our argument is that the nature of these claims, by definition, requires an individual inquiry, fact-intensive individual inquiry of the members here, and an inquiry involving the members' circumstances. The first reason we say that, aside from looking at each and every one of the four causes of action, dealt largely with the fact that in the trade association's petitions, the original through all the way through the third amended, they had a section in their pleadings called relevant facts. And it was a long section. By self-admission from the plaintiffs, they are saying these are the facts that are relevant to our four causes of action. In fact, each cause of action as set forth in the petition incorporated this relevant facts section. So right off the bat, the fact that they say all of these facts, these relevant facts, relate to each cause of action shows in our mind, and we set forth what those relevant facts were all through our brief, raised in our mind right off the bat, gosh, there's a bunch of relevant facts that are relevant to each individual member's circumstances as pled by the trade associations.
Well, can I interrupt a second?
Yes.
Don't all of those relevant facts and don't the fees that the trade associations are complaining about affect every single oil and gas operator in the city that has urban drilling within the city equally? I mean, what is it about the relevant facts that raises an inquiry as to individual circumstances?
Well, I think the first thing about the relevant facts and what it raised is right off the bat, if you look at those relevant facts, the trade association stated that these fees are unreasonable because, and they had this long soliloquy about how much they had benefited the city by drilling, how much money everybody had made. And there was sort of this not really implicit argument, a direct argument, that they said, because of that, how could any more fees here be reasonable? Reasonableness goes to the heart of many of these direct causes of action, not to mention the vested property issue with public safety. It goes to the equal protection claim. It went to the exaction claim of rough proportionality. But that wasn't all. If that was just it, then I think that would be enough. But they in their relevant facts section, they also incorporated this whole idea of equal protection, that the members are not being treated equally. And they had this list they produced of, really, we called it in our brief, of various businesses, activities, and materials. And they said, oh, look at this fee. It's $2,400 for our members, but here's a list of people they believe are doing the same thing, or at least ostensibly, and theirs is only $55 and sometimes $250. Again, that relevant fact goes directly to similarly situated component of equal protection.
But the trade members, the members that you're contending to lack associational standing, those trade members, as to them, it was all applied equally. In any equal protection claim, you're going to have to establish that it was not applied equally to similarly situated individuals or entities. But that can't be the need for individual proof as to other similarly situated businesses. I don't see how that can...
No, I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
To the extent I misunderstood that question. There's no question that this $2,400 permit fee applied equally to all of their members.
Okay.
I agree with that. But the point is, I think, is you have to go behind that and these initial relevant facts and then into each individual cause of action and ask, what is the nature of that claim? What are the elements of proof that the trade associations would have to bring forward to prove that claim on behalf of their members? And will that then require this factual intensive inquiry or inquiry as to the circumstances? And just so, for example, the first one we have is vested property rights claim. There's a provision in the local government code, it's 245.002, and it basically stands for the proposition that at the time a oil and gas operator, in this case, gets an original permit, that this section says, really, after that, you can't go back and change sort of the regulations or the requirements, they have to be the same. And if you do, it would essentially deprive that oil and gas operator of a vested property right. Fair enough. But we pled that there's an exemption to that requirement, and the exemption deals with a public safety component, which says 245.002, this requirement doesn't apply if the regulation is preventing injury to person. And of course, that's our position in this case. We have this urban drilling, and we are very concerned about protecting the safety of our citizens. So we pled and claimed that there's an exemption to vested property rights. So that raises the specter of safety. What is each operator doing? What safety protocols do they have?
But are the fees applied based on any aspect of safety? Aren't the fees that are paid uniform?
Yes, they're paid uniform by each person, but in order for a member to prove a vested property right deprivation, they would have to overcome our pleaded exemption. And to do that, how can a trade member, sure, they can come in and say, yeah, we're going to pay the same $2,400, but the point being, each member is going to have to show a peculiar set of facts as to them regarding this public safety exemption. In other words, not every operator
But wouldn't that be your burden to come in and show that this exemption applied.
And if it is, the point I guess I'm trying to make is, how can I prove that if I can't go to each individual member and say, well, what is your safety record?
Well, wouldn't you have a record of if the exemption applied or didn't apply? I mean, wouldn't you have a record of if you...
I don't believe so. I mean, the exemption says if this regulation is to protect the interest, the public safety, really injury to persons, which we claim that's what we're doing with this regulation, this $2,400 is going
right.
to... Then the question is, for us to prove that, if they're going to claim, oh, no, this is just changing the landscape, it's a vested property right you're taking from us, and we want to prove our exemption, we have to then come in and say, well, as to this operator, what's your safety record, your true safety record? What's your safety protocols? Are you really emergency prepared? Can you show us that none of this are exemption as to personal safety and injury to our...
I guess I'm just reading the statute differently than you, because you have it cited on page 24 of your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm reading it to say that you cannot charge more, you cannot alter the regulation unless it has a safety purpose. And so you would have to have decided before the assessment or before the fee was increased that it was necessary for a safety purpose in order for the exemption to apply, in order for it not to be a violation of a vested property right, is the way that I'm reading the statute. And if that's incorrect, then please explain to me your position on the statutory application.
Yes, Your Honor. I think our position is when it says this chapter does not apply, in other words, this concept of original permit, no new regulations after, simply does not apply if the regulation that is being enacted is to prevent the imminent destruction of property or injuries to person. And so we have shown, we believe that that's what this is designed to do.
So your position is it just doesn't apply from the get-go?
Yes, but if we have to prove that it was designed to prevent injury to persons, then as to each individual trade member who's claiming no, it doesn't, I mean, that's their defense back. I don't know how we can prove that. And let me add one thing. This whole vested property argument, one of the things they kept saying back was, oh, don't worry about all that. None of that matters because we're safe. That was the big theme of their relevant facts. We have a perfect safety record. Don't worry. And number two, they said, by the way, none of that's relevant because we've offered to train your people. In lieu of this, you don't need this fee. You don't need this equipment and this training. This fee is going to pay for because we'll train for you. So, again, our hands are tied. It's like, well, we have to prove that. But let me give another example. The equal protection claim, I think, is by analogy the same. Our position is that they're claiming you have natural gas operators and this whole group of others on this list. Our position is how could they prove an equal protection claim without going down this list and truly showing that each individual member is truly engaged in the type of activity or using the type of materials that people on this list are using. That is the component part of similarly situated. It's not that the members are being treated unequally amongst themselves. It's that they're being treated unequally vis-a-vis the people on this list. And that's why they said this list in their brief, they said other businesses that produce, use, transport, dispense, dispose, store, handle flammable, combustible, or hazardous materials. That's the group that the members are comparing themselves to. How can we ever know if the members are truly situated with all of those entities and activities on that list if we can't figure out what the members are doing themselves? Are the members using the same hazardous materials? Is each member operating with the same materials?
But your provision imposing the fee says oil and gas operators.
Correct. That's one class. That's one
group.
That's
the class.
But equal protection requires one group being compared or treated unequally from another identifiable group. And the identifiable group, we didn't identify this group, they did. They said there's a list of other groups in Arlington that are paying these de minimis fees, and they have a list that says here's everything they do, here's the materials they use, here's the type of businesses they are, and we're not being treated fairly equally with these. It would be their burden to show that those people are truly similarly situated. That's the very essence of an equal protection claim. And we can't prove that. the city of Arlington may be able to figure out what these other businesses do. But to compare them and say they're similarly situated, I've got to get particularized proof from each member if they're engaging in the same type of activity, using the same hazardous materials, or they're not similarly situated.
So how did the city know? How does the city know whether to impose the higher fee against a company or a business based on its being an oil and gas operator versus one of those other?
Well, here the evidence showed that they did an exhaustive study and came up with what the fire chief and the fire department believed was necessary to get this fee to provide the services they thought were necessary for safety. And that's how they came up with the $2,400 fee. But as to all the others, again, that's why it's so critical to show these are similarly situated. It's not fair for the member to say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of time, I apologize.
I have a question for Mr.
Okay.
Just one, if I might, and ask indulgence from my colleagues.
Oh, sure. Please.
Mr. Spence, what permit or what number of permits exists between the City of Arlington and Texas Oil and Gas Association?
None that I'm aware of.
What about Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association?
I do not believe any.
Well, those are not permit holders that are parties to this litigation.
That's correct.
So they only can act through the permit holders if what they're doing is complaining about a violation of 25.002, because you got to look at the individual permit holders to get to that statute in any way.
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Spence.
Thank you.
Reserve 5 minutes for your rebuttal. And we'll hear from David Johnson on behalf of the Appalese.
May it please the court, Mr. Spence. Thank you for your time this afternoon. I appreciate it. I think the very first thing we have to do is in looking at whether this tax and whether these regulations are proper is to think about how they came about creating them. They've created a flat rate, $2,400 per well tax. At the time where there's been no blowouts, no injuries, no one has even had to be evacuated from any of these well sites. And also, with regard to these regulations, if there were some sort of incident, the operator would have to reimburse the city for any kind of action they took. And moreover, the testimony in the case is that the city's employees wouldn't even do anything to put a well fire out. They would hire some other expert, or the member operator would hire an expert to come do it. So why was it necessary to have $2,400 per well tax? Well, they came to that because they just wanted some new fire people. And it was about $700,000 to $800,000. So they took that amount, divided by the number of wells. And that's the way they came up with this tax. It's a flat rate, categorical fee. The city did not have any individualized inquiry. It didn't go through and say, oh, this is a really safe operator, so we're only going to charge you $5. Oh, this, you're a terrible operator, we're going to charge you $5,000. There was no individualized inquiry whatsoever with regard to this tax. My clients, Texoga and Tipro, are trade organizations. They have filed this suit under associational standing doctrine. They have to have three elements for associational standing. An association doesn't itself have to have a dog in the fight, as it were. It doesn't have to have a permit to be able to bring a claim. They're the first two elements of associational standing covers that. And those two elements are that the party's members have standing to sue on their own behalf, and clearly our operators would. And secondly, that the interests we're trying to protect are germane to our purpose. They don't even argue those two elements apply in this case. It's undisputed they do. The only thing we're talking about here is the third element, which is whether the nature of the claim, nor the relief sought, requires participation of our individual members in the lawsuit. Now, the trial court correctly found that was met and denied their standing motion. And the court, I think it's important to note, this is a claim-by-claim analysis. It doesn't have to be an all or nothing. You have to go by claim to see if we have standing for each particular claim. And I think we need to also set straight kind of the standing test that we're talking about here today. And I think the briefing maybe is a little different from each side. I mean, we certainly say the same element, but the way we interpret it seems to be very different. With regard to What's interesting is to hear opposing counsel say, well, you judge it by the claims that were raised. Well, that's exactly right. You judge it by the claims that are raised. And do we have to have individual members to prove an element of our claim? Their defenses are completely irrelevant in the context of standing. So the fact that they may bring some affirmative defense or they have some issue they have the burden to prove is irrelevant for standing. Now, obviously very relevant for the merits of the case, but it's irrelevant for standing. Secondly, it is require. Does the individual members of our organization, are they required to prove an element of our claim? Not that they simply want that evidence, or they may have some relevant evidence, but do we have to have that to succeed? And the perfect example of that typically is a suit for damages. An association brings a suit for damages. You have to have your individual members there that have been affected to prove your claim for damages. Courts say you don't have a associational standing in that circumstance. That's not what we have here. We've only pled for declaratory relief. We've only pled for prospective relief. And the courts routinely say, and Mr. Spence acknowledges, that that's the general rule. The general rule is if you ask for prospective relief, then essentially you have associational standing. And maybe there are some circumstances where if you ask for declaratory relief or injunctive relief that you don't, but those are very far far between. And Mr. Spence didn't even give us an example. Also, I will also note, it says that the third prong states that individual members have to be necessary. It doesn't say some members. It doesn't say one member. It says all of the members. And I think that is important. And if you look at the kind of one of the original Texas U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with this element, the Worth case, which has been cited in our briefs, the Worth case sets this third element as follows. So long as the nature of the claim and the relief sought does not make the individual participation of each injured party indispensable to proper resolution of the cause, then the plaintiff has associational standing. So do we have to have all of our affected members present to proceed? I think the case here, clearly, you wouldn't have to have all of our members. If one of our members filed this lawsuit, we could have the exact same relief as what we've pled from the associations. So the fact that that one member may have some relevant evidence does not mean that we don't have associational standing. And finally, it's whether the participation is necessary in the lawsuit at trial. It's not if, you know, Mr. Spence is saying, oh, well, gosh, how can we go find this evidence? I mean, it's just impossible. Well, I think there's a subpoena process. I think you can take depositions. I think you can get evidence from non-parties in the state of Texas. So I don't think that in and of itself is dispositive on the issue of standing. If the court were to take the interpretation that the city takes in this case, basically no party would ever have associational standing. Almost any time you have a case with an association, a member will have some relevant evidence. Whether it is, I got the notice, you know, I got the ticket, the violation, whatever it is, that doesn't mean that the association doesn't have standing. And the fact that you have a sampling of members come in is completely appropriate. And the Fifth Circuit has held that in the Texas Medical Board case, which we've cited in our opinion. I'm sorry, in our brief. There's another issue in this case I want to talk about, and that's facial versus as applied. The city says, well, there's not really a test, and those kind of things are kind of wishy-washy, and all of their claims are as applied claims. Well, neither one of those things are true. First of all, we do have a test. It's from the Garcia case, which has been cited in our brief, 893 Southwest 2nd 504, Texas Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court clearly says that a facial challenge is when you're saying this statute or this ordinance is improper in all instances. And as applied is, well, it's normally okay, but in this particular instance, for this particular party, it is not appropriate. Well, you can see that when you're talking about an as-applied challenge, associational standing becomes more difficult. It's not impossible, but it's more difficult because you're having to argue a particular member's incident, saying why that was unfair for that one particular member, versus a facial challenge, you're saying it's improper in all circumstances. Is completely appropriate for associational standing because the relief we seek will benefit every single one of our members. In fact, if we win on this case, it'll help every other operator who's not a member of our organizations that wants to drill in the city of Arlington or who has a well in the city of Arlington. So clearly here we have facial challenges to the statutes. There is a rule for it, and I think that supports the fact that we do have associational standing. Also, on the burden of proof, here, our Third Amendment petition is a relevant petition. A lot of the statements that they have continued to bring up was in a prior pleading, which we have amended and taken a lot of those statements out because they're not necessary. The fact that our particular members are really safe, or the fact that they've offered to help, not in our most current pleading that was on file before the hearing. And so that is the appropriate inquiry. And so the issue then becomes, well, what burden do they have? Well, because we pled facts and are pleading to support associational standing, they have the burden to come forward with the burden of production to prove that our facts are wrong. It's kind of like a summary judgment motion, traditional motion for summary judgment. They have the burden. What evidence do they have attached to their motion that proved that we don't have associational standing? Once again, they're only challenging the third element. So what evidence do they have that we're going to have our members there to prove every single element of every single one of our claims? Zero evidence. All they have are requests for production responses saying that we don't have responsive documents. They don't have any evidence that experts couldn't have that evidence, that other non-members couldn't have that evidence. So they haven't met their very prima facie threshold to even get this element, this issue to the trial court. And that's why I think that's one reason why the trial court ruled for us. Getting to the claims that we're talking about in this case, you know, it's funny because the city just seems to want to completely skip our unconstitutional occupation tax claim, which is the first claim we pled. And that one simply says that municipalities cannot place a tax on an occupation that is not taxed by the state. Oil and gas operators aren't taxed by the state. Therefore, it is an unconstitutional occupation tax. And the facts of this case are almost exactly on point with the Loewenberg case, which we've cited in our brief, a Texas Supreme Court from 2008, saying that this kind of fee is an occupation tax. We don't have to have any of our members present to support that. And they don't make an argument on it. They've, in my opinion, waived their argument in their appellant's brief. The next issue is our exaction claim. And I think this gets back to the issue of, well, is it our claim or is it a defense? I think everyone agrees that this was an exaction. It's a regulatory taking. They are conditioning a issue of a permit based upon these rather large, excessive fees. That is an exaction. What they're saying is, well, but it's okay because the condition, because they have an affirmative defense. The condition imposed upon the development bears an essential nexus to the substantial advancement of some legitimate governmental interest, and the condition imposed is roughly proportional to the projected impact of the proposed development. Well, that's an affirmative defense. It is something that they may want evidence to support, since they have the burden to prove, but that is completely irrelevant to our standing inquiry. Even if you were to look at that, and we briefed this extensively, they've only claimed that the second element is at issue and would require individualized participation, and it goes to the rough proportionality test. Is the impact of our oil and gas wells roughly proportional to the tax they want to give? And they're saying, well, we have to have individualized inquiries in each one of our operators. That is just not true. It's not true because, A, they didn't create the tax that way. They don't say $5 for this one, $500 for that one, $5,000 for that one. It's $2,400 for every single one of them. And so what they've done is they've just made a global inquiry. Well, I think they just wanted to fund some new firemen. But what they've done is globally said, well, here's the energy industry, here's the operators. And so, you know, I think what we can do and what we should do is have evidence of what the industry, and you can have experts to come in and prove that. It doesn't require an individualized inquiry into each one of our members to prove rough proportionality. And in fact, this isn't just theoretical. We have motions for summary judgment on file in the trial court based on the merits, and this claim is one of them. We filed a motion for summary judgment based on our exaction claim saying we win based on the merits. Guess what the city did? They filed a response, didn't ask for a continuance, and say, oh, we need more time to take discovery from your members. No, they attached affidavits and evidence from their expert saying that this rough proportionality test was met. So they admit, I mean, I think, I don't know if that's a judicial admission or what, but they have filed a response, didn't ask for continuance, said, yes, this case is ripe for disposition, and here's expert testimony proving up this test. We don't need individualized participation for the exaction claim. Equal protection. It is our burden of proof to show that the natural gas well operators are similarly situated with other businesses on that list. But that, in and of itself, does not require a member-by-member investigation. Once again, that is an industry investigation. You can have experts, you can have public knowledge, and other governmental documents tell you how safe the oil and gas industry is, and operators are in general, and weigh that compared to the taxes that are in place here. And it's interesting to note that they're charging us $2,400 per well when they only charge people handling hydrogen chloride, which is a weapon of mass destruction. They only have to pay less than $400. And a gas well operator has $2,400 per well, which you can have multiple wells on one pad site. So once again, because you can have experts, because you can look at it from a group perspective, which is the way they created the tax, you don't need to have individualized participation. Same thing on the vested rights. Their affirmative defense of imminent destruction and injury to persons, that's their affirmative defense. Our claim doesn't require any participation of our members. And once again, you can have experts come in and prove what kind of imminent danger there is for that purpose. Once again, Your Honors, the parties have filed merits-based motions for summary judgment. This case is ripe for disposition based on the merits of the case. We ask that this trial court affirm the trial court's correct standing determination and remand so that the trial court can quickly move to a summary judgment hearing and get this case disposed of. We appreciate your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Johnson and Mr. Spence,
thank
rebuttal.
You. Appreciate it, yes. Very quickly, first with this statement that we had no test stated for facial versus applied challenges that was raised in the appellee's brief and in our reply brief at page 19 and 20. I even cite the very case that opposing counsel refers to, the Garcia test. The problem is, and I think the reality in this case is, these are not facial challenges. There's a case from this court, Hinterlong versus Arlington ISD from 2010. Facial challenges are statutes which, by their terms, on their face, always operate to be unconstitutional. There's nothing about the plain language of this permit statute that says an annual operational permit is required to drill, operate, maintain on natural gas wells. There's nothing about the face of that statute that makes it always unconstitutional. These are nothing but applied claims. Applied says is a challenge that you claim it operates unconstitutionally when applied to a challenger's particular circumstances. And that's what all of these claims are making are. They are not facial challenges. And why is that important? Because on page 13 of their brief, here's what the trade associations admit. Thus, the gas industry parties do not raise as applied challenges that would require an analysis of the gas industry's parties' individual members' circumstances. That's exactly the point we're making. They've admitted here that if these are applied challenges, the very test for associational standing, an inquiry into each member's circumstances, is required. Again, that's on page 13 of their brief. The second issue, the trade associations repeatedly say, look, we don't need to get information from our members. We can use experts. And the irony is that's the exact argument that was raised in the Big Rock Investors case. In that case, the exact same thing. The parties there said, wait, there was a receiver appointed, and we can get experts, and we're going to come in and let those people talk about all this.
But I think the distinction there is that in the Big Rock case, it was the association attempting to use an expert in lieu of a fact-intensive individual examination of each member of the association, versus in this case where it's the defense that is claiming that they need to use experts to do some kind of fact-intensive analysis to benefit the defense.
Well, I don't believe that's true, Your Honor, and I think if on their briefs at page 13, 18, 42, 46, 50, and 53, they repeatedly say the parties can use experts, including them, and that's their position. And that's exactly what happened in Big Rock is that, and the point how it ties in is they said, the associations there said, this will minimize the need for members to have to be involved. And that's exactly what they're arguing. That's just what he just argued. He said, we don't have to have members. We'll just have experts that can talk about all this.
He might have said they need experts, but I didn't hear him say that they needed an expert in lieu of fact-intensive, individualized examination of each association member.
Yeah, I believe that's what on page 13, 18, 42, 46, 50, and 53 of their brief, with each cause of action, they say that. They say, we don't need these members because this can all be explained by experts. So I think that is their position. And again, that's exactly like the Big Rock case. The other thing in Big Rock that I wanted to bring out is, you know, this court said ultimately the test was, it said instead courts look to whether plaintiff association that is pleading for equitable relief on behalf of its members has established that any individualized evidence required to prosecute the claim would be duplicative and redundant, thus advancing this prudential concept. Of course, here, that's exactly the point I think we're trying to make, is that they're claiming, in fact, when we asked them for discovery, their position was not only do we not have it, we don't have any information about any of this, it's not within our possession, custody, or control, go ask third parties, i.e. our individual members. And so the idea that somehow they're going to have some evidence on their own as trade associations that is ultimately going to render evidence from their members redundant is just nonsensical based on their own arguments. I mean, that's exactly what happened. When they pled all these relevant facts about what they claimed belonged to all these causes of action, we crafted a set of discovery based on that. And their answer to every request was, we don't have any of that, we don't have possession, custody, or control of it, can't get it from our members, you can go get it from our members if you need to. So I don't know how else that doesn't meet the test, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Spence. Thanks to both sets of lawyers, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate your briefs and your arguments, and your case is submitted. You're excused, and